Hello, Americans. This is Orson Welles Broadcasting. Glad to be back with you again this week. Well, I flew in from San Francisco the other night. And the talk on the plane, on that beautiful moonlit night among my friends and neighbors, sitting there with their seatbelts on, waiting to land in San Francisco, was all of war and the threat of war. A lot of the folks I know, here on the West Coast and on the East Coast, people who write me, people I talk to, and people I overhear in public places are concerned with war clouds and the proximity of atom warfare. I think the Wallace speech, the Wallace letter, and the Wallace resignation have brought into sharp focus many of the problems relevant to this. But really nothing new has happened, nothing we couldn't have guessed. I remember that even in the first weeks, it was clear to most of us who covered that first conference in San Francisco. The free world, whose armies and factories and soldiers and peoples had beaten down the enemies of peace, that free world was splitting in two. That free world wasn't one world anymore. The victorious partnership of powers called the United Nations was dividing and conquering itself. Most of us, correspondents of the newspapers of the world, assigned to observe and report upon that hopeful gathering of the diplomats of the world, I remember made early comment on the split widening between the East and the West. There were grave differences of outlook between us correspondents. There were differences between our publishers, even more sizable and serious. But on the main outline of our subject, that first conference, we shared unhappy agreement. We might be wiring our news stories to Pravda of Moscow or the Clarion Sentinel and Dispatch of East Upditch, Illinois, wherever we sent our copy and whatever our separate attitudes and special instructions. We all knew, and most of us were saying, that UN, we called it UNO in those days, was coming apart at the seams. Last year's war unity was gone with last winter's snows, even as the United Nations Charter was being hammered into words. Its principles were dissolving in words. Russia was too suspicious, even then in San Francisco. The cynicism of her spokesman tainted the sweet air. Oh, yes, the air in those early eager days hadn't been soured with international abusiveness, smudged up with legalistic bickering, befouled with broken promises. Russia, of course, felt isolated in a capitalist world society. I remember the men with their portfolios under their arms walking the streets of San Francisco as though they were not only in foreign country, but in enemy country. And when we saw the copies of the Chicago Tribune being flown into them by airmail, flown into all the delegates, we began to understand how they felt and why they felt that way. But Russia came out of the war a great victor, and a great victory, a huge new power among the nations, the hearty appetite for growth. Britain was facing the first shock of its lowered and lowering prestige. The U.S. had just awakened to the news that it was the strongest and richest country in the records of civilization. It was San Francisco a year ago, but at this breathless moment of realizing our wealth, we who were Americans had to face an impoverishment very terrible indeed. Franklin Roosevelt was suddenly gone. And we were the partisans of the people's cause, we who were enlisted on his side of the battle everywhere, from the Andes to the Alps, looked into the blank smile of a little man from Missouri, a very decent but a very little politician, with all the virtues and all the vision of Main Street. Mr. Harry Truman, for a number of none too good or sufficient reasons, had inherited the biggest job in the whole history of the human race. You know, I heard him admit one day, not long before he became president, that he, Mr. Truman, didn't know a thing about foreign policy. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is the captain of the mightiest state in the mightiest of grand alliances. In one checkered year, he has committed in his easygoing way, I think, more than one politician's quota of cheerful blunders. The latest we might call Operation Wallace. lot of excitement still raging about Operation Wallace, but the smoke's beginning to clear, so we can begin to make a little sense about it. The best sense, of course, is contained in what Henry Wallace himself said. I want one thing clearly understood. It's what he said. I am neither anti-British nor pro-British, neither anti-Russian nor pro-Russian. And just 2 days ago, when President Truman read these words, he said they represented the policy of his administration. Unquote. Henry Wallace is a great man. He's a very good man. That much we can be certain of, and I think the greatness is beginning to show through, even when the political wisdom wears a little thin. Whether progressives like it or not, he is their accredited spokesman. I respect him for everything he has accomplished, for his huge integrity and for his great courage, however mistaken it may have been at this moment. I'm also very fond of him as a friend. I'd like to tell you a little story about Henry Wallace, my friend. Oh, not so very long ago, somebody, a sailor from South Africa, gave Mr. Wallace a large cane with an excessively large silver knob. A flashy and flamboyant article of furniture, to be sure, and I saw Mr. Wallace walking along rather ruefully on his way to the train, holding it, as though it didn't belong at all to him, but glad to have the present, and I was seeing him off on the station. I'd just gone to get him a paper, and he said, "Here, Orson, you take the cane." I said, "I can't accept anything as nice as that. It's very valuable." He said, "All right, I won't give it to you. I'll loan it to you." I think the assumption was that I am sufficiently flashy and flamboyant to carry such a thing as that cane. I think that's why Mr. Wallace gave it to me. Anyway, it's a treasured possession. I'm afraid that he complimented me in thinking that I had sufficient style to walk around with a cane about the size of two fists, but I'd like to try it someday. There's a condition that went with the loan. He said, "You can have this cane on loan from me for as long as you do good deeds. Every year you report, and if you don't figure you're doing good deeds, then you give me back the cane." Nice little ceremony, and I appreciated it, and I've reported a couple of times now. Tonight or maybe tomorrow, I'm getting on a plane flying to Providence to take Henry Wallace's place at the meeting in Providence, which was to mark the occasion of his second speech on this question of foreign policy. I may take exception to Mr. Burns as well, or to rather, I may take exception to Mr. Wallace on a few points. In the main, however, I will be an understudy, and a very poor one, I'm sure the audience will find, but I'm going because I have a great deal to say on my own, and I would like to explain on the air first so that the sponsors will have time to notify me that I don't need to come, that there are certain points where I will not follow the what might be described as the pure Wallace line. I don't know what the Wallace line is. I think I know what he believes in. I've also studied this recent and apparently very atomic speech. Incidentally, the letter which caused all the trouble, I think I can tell you now, I have it on very reliable authority from Washington, that the leak to Drew Pearson, who printed the letter, you know, and who was denounced by Henry Wallace for having filched it, which Drew Pearson denies. The letter was leaked to Drew Pearson by the State Department in order to force a break between Wallace and Truman. It's a fairly important revelation which I'm making on this subject, but as I said before, my authority is pretty good. Well, you know, from my dough, the sad thing about all this resignation business and weakening of Burns's hands in Paris and general misery is not so much that the vaunted bipartisan unity has been destroyed or impaired. I'm not even saddened by this fresh instance of Mr. Truman's political incompetence. No, I'm sorry to see the world in such a state of helter-skelter retreat that the Wallace speech can seem like appeasement to one half of the electorate and like a definitive restatement of the Roosevelt International morality to the other. The Wallace speech in question and the Wallace letter, which is an extension of the same, is neither. It is neither the Roosevelt International morality nor appeasement of Russia. Henry Wallace doesn't want to appease the Russians. He just wants to drop... He just doesn't want to drop bombs on them. He wants to avoid bomb dropping in general. But Henry Wallace says what's happening in Eastern Europe is no business of ours. And what's going on in Bulgaria and Romania is none of our business any more than what's happening in South America is any of Russia's business. And it's just here, and here only, that I would take exception to any of Henry Wallace's points, because for my dough, ladies and gentlemen, what's going on in Eastern Europe is very much our business, and what's going on in South America is Russia's business, that what's happening everywhere is everybody's business. In a word, I'll say this. Getting tough with Russia won't stop a war. Getting soft with Russia won't stop a war. You may say, is there no way then of stopping a war? Yes, there is. By building a free world where wars can't happen because they just plain don't make sense. Well, how do you build a free world? The answer is easy, but the job is hard. You build a free world the way our pioneer fathers built a fort, by clearing a place in the wilderness and everybody pitching in and grunting and sweating mightily till it's all done. If our pioneer fathers had divided the first settlements and gathered in separate camps and built stockades separately with guns pointing at each other, the wilderness would have gone back to the wolves. But our pioneer fathers, for all their individualistic land greed, mutual suspicions, political and religious differences, got along together somehow because they shared common enemies, the savages and the elements, the wilderness itself, which they'd ridden out to battle and to beat. Because they acknowledged common enemies, the United Nations got along together during the war. No such enemies are shared today. No enemies are recognized, but they exist. They aren't shooting enemies, but they're entirely fatal. Are you a Hindu or a Muslim or a subscriber to the Chicago Tribune? Whatever you are, the enemy is no single nation in the United Nations, because no one of those nations or any grouping of them wants war. The enemies are not to be found in particular force on any side of any national boundary. The enemies are everywhere, behind every line. They are the enemies of progress, the professional wreckers of peace. They are involved in the best organized of all conspiracies, the old international plot against the people. Besides the experts, they are the simple aspects of defeat. Not people at all, the things. They've been called the forces of darkness, hunger and hate, greed and sickness and fear. These are enemies shared by all the United Nations. They can only be overcome by all the United Nations working together like the pioneers they are or ought to be in this new fight against the wilderness. A tough policy or a soft policy are both admissions of war as the end of the argument. We cannot found an enduring peace by appeasement or by bullying. Unless the powers occupy their restless energies and sublimate their respective suspicions in a total global offensive as thorough as a shooting war against what makes a shooting war, we'll have a shooting war. The ultimate enemy of peace in our time or any time is no one nation or alliance of nations. The ultimate enemy of peace is the very principle of nations. The problem is not what to do about the Russians. The problem is what to do about the perverse survival in this brave new age of the atom of competitive nationalism, a luxury or rather an old-fashioned bad habit this shrinking globe of ours no longer has the room or leisure to support. That's what I'm going to Providence to say in effect in taking Mr. Wallace's place, and I hope that he'll say at the end of the trip that I get to keep his cane. Now my time is up for this Sunday. Thanks for coming to call. Till next Sunday, I remain as always obediently yours.
Next week, those of you who live in communities now observing daylight saving time will once again return to standard time. But this station will continue to bring you Orson Welles at the same time you heard him today. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.